Hey everyone, I'm David Chalian, CNN's political director, and welcome to the CNN Political Briefing. This week is historic. For the first time ever, a former president of the United States is a defendant in a criminal trial.
This is an outrage that this case was brought. This is a persecution like never before. Nobody's ever seen anything like it. And again, it's a case that should have never been brought.
And that's not all. This is the first of four expected criminal trials involving Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee for president in 2024. And at the same time, this week, the Supreme Court also heard oral arguments on the obstruction charges used to prosecute rioters involved in January 6th. This case could affect the federal election subversion case against Donald Trump as well. Safe to say, the former president is in a tangled web of legal troubles. Here to help us understand it all and the impact it could have on Trump's campaign is former U.S. Ambassador Norm Eisen. He's a CNN legal analyst, and he also served as counsel to the House Judiciary Committee for the first impeachment and trial of Donald Trump. Ambassador, thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, David. Always a pleasure.
So you have been sitting in the courtroom in Manhattan during this jury selection process. And I know there are a lot of people who would be like, okay, is jury selection that compelling? I've been riveted by it because I do think it's something every one of us understands, those of us that have been called to jury duty and understand all that that entails, and that these everyday Manhattanites may be placed on the first ever jury to adjudicate guilt and innocence in a criminal trial of a former president. And so first, I just want to get your overall takeaways of what you've experienced in court.
David, I've been going to court as a practicing attorney for over 30 years, picked juries, served on juries, probably thousands of days in court over the decades. And in one regard, what I've observed is totally ordinary. The criminal jury selection process in action. It bears many resemblances to ordinary case. And in another regard, because these ordinary people, seven of them have already been chosen to sit in judgment on a former president of the United States, it's one of the most remarkable jury selections that I've ever seen and in the history of our country. And I share your fascination. And I have been drinking up the information about the jurors. It's like meeting jurors when you're sitting there for voir dire, the jury interview process, because they're asked so many questions. You know, in this case, it's really the most elaborate questionnaire that I've ever seen. And each juror has to stand up and answer 42 questions. What neighborhood do you live in? A bunch of questions about the employer, your education, are you married, do you have children? You get the most intimate details about these jurors and you really feel like you're getting to know them. Of course, we're very strictly forbidden from talking to them when we pass them in the halls or see them. They try to keep us pinned away. I was in the courtroom for the argument a couple weeks ago, what was supposed to be the first day of trial. In the jury selection process, only the pool, which includes our CNN poolers, a handful of reporters is physically present in the courtroom, and the rest of us are in the overflow room where the proceedings are televised. But in a way, you can't see the jurors. They block the jurors from being viewed for juror protections. But you do hear everything. And so it's been a fascinating process. And the bottom line of the process, David, as you would expect when you gather seven Manhattanites, I'm sure Donald Trump is feeling a little anxious. And we saw some of that come out. You can study him and you can see his anxiety coming out.
In what ways, Norm?
There was a confrontation, maybe the most dramatic confrontation that we've seen so far in these 2 days between Donald Trump and the judge. Because when one of the jurors was called back in, they interview the jurors, they fill up the jury box, and they interview the jurors in a group. And the first one stands up, and then you answer the questions. And if there's an issue, then they send all the jurors out, and the lawyers talk about, well, this juror seemed unfair. And then they call the juror back if the judge wants to ask more questions. They called one very liberal juror back. And Trump must have thought this juror was not being honest because he was carrying on. He was speaking audibly so the juror in the courtroom could hear. He was gesticulating. He was leaning over. And the judge came down on him like a ton of bricks. The judge said, I will not tolerate juror intimidation in my courtroom. And he said to Trump's lawyer, Todd Blanche, you counsel your client.
Now, when you observed this, Norm, when you observed this, did you believe Donald Trump was trying to intimidate a potential juror?
I think Donald Trump was engaging in conduct that the juror could have found intimidating.
Okay. Now, I do want to say something you said about the biases of these jurors, and I do think it's important for our listeners to understand there's sort of a two-step process here, and I want to get your expertise on this, sort of your assessment of how the judge is handling this. But Judge Merchan himself, after going through the questionnaire you described with all these jurors, can dismiss people for cause because they say simply off the top right away, I don't think I could be an impartial juror. And he says, goodbye. You're not. I don't want somebody who doesn't think that they could be an impartial juror. That is, I guess, not technically what you described as voir dire, which is when the prosecutors from Alvin Bragg's office, the Manhattan DA, and the defense counsel for former President Trump have the ability to execute 10 strikes on each side. They have to use a strike to say they don't believe they want that juror in the box because of whatever reason. It's a peremptory strike and they can get rid of it, but they're limited to each side having 10. Now, this judge has been quite liberal. I don't mean liberal politically, but has been quite free to really let people excuse themselves of saying they just can't be fair in this, or their politics are they where they are, or they discuss politics with friends and all their friends are liberal. And however it is, he really has gotten rid of a ton of the potential jurors just off the top before the defense counsel and the prosecution even really start weighing in, correct?
Correct. And it was controversial because normal procedure is for the judge not to dismiss jurors out of hand, because you lose a lot of jurors that way. Nevertheless, the judge decided that in his experience, he wrote a written decision on this. He said, in my experience, the vast majority of jurors who start out by saying they cannot be fair and impartial end up being dismissed. We have too much work to do. It's going to waste too much time to examine them individually. I'm going to let them leave. And out of our first pool of 96, we lost more than half. We lost over 50 jurors that way. But by the end of the day, Tuesday, they had picked 7 jurors. That's a faster pace than anyone expected. So the judge turned out to be pretty smart. I would offer a friendly amendment. There's really 3 levels to it. First, the judge rejects people out of hand. And then sometimes during when you get to the voir dire, the questioning, he lets people go who, as they answer these questions, the answers are not really what you need in a juror. By the way, that included a very promising Republican juror for Trump. You could see Trump's counsel table very disappointed when this gentleman said, well, I grew up among Republicans. I can't really be fair. That's level one, the judge. Then you have challenges for cause, unlimited. And that's where both sides say, judge, you rule. I think there's bias here. And both sides won and lost some of those. Then if all else fails, you get 10 peremptory strikes, you get to cut 10 jurors for whatever reason you want. That's your insurance policy if the judge says, no, I'm keeping a juror. And both sides exercised some of their peremptory strikes and reserved some because we have days to go.
Two additional quick questions for you here. One, this is shorthanded a lot in media coverage and elsewhere as the so-called hush money trial. But paying someone to keep quiet is not actually necessarily an illegal activity, and that is not the core of what the charges are here. How would you describe what the charges are in this case?
This case is really one of alleged criminal election influence or election interference, much like we described the 2020 election interference case. Don't take my word for it, David. The judge, in the first substantive words that he spoke to the jury, said the allegations are that Trump falsified business records. That's the crime here. Falsifies business records to conceal an agreement to unlawfully influence the 2016 presidential election. And this is a judge who's scrupulously fair. I disagree, for example, with some of his other decisions, not to let in the Access Hollywood tape or to give Trump an entire week plus to respond to the alleged violations of the gag order. The judge is bending over backwards. Why does he say it's an unlawful election influence case? Because the crime here of falsifying business records is only a felony if it's done with the intent to conceal something else. And the thing that's being concealed here, this payment that was made was to Stephanie Clifford, to Stormy Daniels, has been charged by Alvin Bragg as an effort to swing the outcome, to deceive voters in the 2016 election to grasp power. Because after the Access Hollywood tape, the campaign was reeling and another scandal would have knocked him out. So the essence of what's happening here, the question that Alvin Bragg is putting to the jury, the proposition that he says he's going to prove is Trump falsified business records in order to cover up his effort to deceive voters, to interfere with the 2016 election in order to avoid losing. And if that sounds familiar, it should, because that is the same pattern, voter deception to grasp power, of the 2020 election interference case. Now, it's one thing to call it, to quote the judge and say it's an election influence or an election interference case. It's another thing for Alvin Bragg to prove it. Donald Trump is innocent until proven guilty, and maybe the jury at the end of the day will say he didn't prove it. But it's a misnomer, as you point out. There is no crime of paying hush money. Right. The crime is falsifying business records to influence an election. And I think, as I wrote for CNN Opinion, I think we should say so.
Norm, my last question on this case for you is, how important do you believe jury selection is? When you look at every component of a trial, you just talked about the burden of proof that's on Alvin Bragg here, and he has to get people to adjudicate this beyond a reasonable doubt unanimously. And I am wondering just where, in all the things in a trial, how important is jury selection?
By the time we get to the end of jury selection on Friday, perhaps next week, before opening statements have been made, the trial will be half over, although we have 4 to 6 weeks ahead of us. In just a few days, trial's half over, because jury selection is at least half the battle. And it's going to be tough here to get an acquittal. I think seven jurors in, I can already tell you that you won't get an acquittal. You're picking a jury that has at least one person on it who will hang the jury, who will go for you as a defense lawyer. They can't admit it. But since I'm not trying this case, I can admit that, of course, you're always trying to do that. That's the defense strategy here. On the prosecution side, they want to try to seat a jury that is open to convicting. We'll see. Donald Trump has had some rough luck with civil juries in Manhattan, just down the block from the courthouse where we are in federal court. Enormous, giant judgment in the second E. Jean Carroll case.
Right.
So we'll see who wins this battle, but it's half the case, David, if not more.
We're going to take a quick break. We're going to have a bit more here with CNN legal analyst Norm Eisen in just a moment.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life, lately, we have been paying attention to a very different virus, bird flu, which is caused by the H5N1 virus. If you start to hear that it's circulating in pigs, that would be a concern.
That means I would go from sleeping with one eye open to one and a half eyes open. Yeah, that would make me very concerned.
Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. We're here with CNN legal analyst, Ambassador Norm Eisen. Norm, one other thing I wanted to get you to weigh in on for me and our listeners here is this big case that was before the Supreme Court of the United States this week. So we are leaving Manhattan here and dealing with something that is at the core of many charges that have been made against January 6th rioters. And it is this issue of interfering with an official proceeding and whether or not prosecutors went beyond the realm of this law dating back to 2002, known as Sarbanes-Oxley, in applying this charge to January 6th rioters. This case went before the United States Supreme Court in oral argument this week. And I'm wondering what you assess of how that oral argument went and what you think potential impact here of how the Supreme Court may rule.
The debate about obstruction of an official proceeding in Congress is whether the wording of the statute means that you can only prosecute if you have obstruction of an official proceeding through destroying, altering, or fabricating documents, or whether violently invading the Congress can qualify as obstructing an official proceeding there, namely the January 6th meeting of Congress, which certainly was disrupted. I believe that the better view, just given the wording of the statute, is that you do not need to obstruct Congress through the abuse of a document. The statute is more capacious. I do think the court was a little dubious about, you know, there was some skepticism expressed. We'll see where they come out on these January 6th rioters. But that's only half the question. Donald Trump is also charged with obstructing an official proceeding of Congress and his activity relating to January 6th.
That's part of Jack Smith's federal indictment against him in the 2020 election interference federal case.
So you could have a big chunk of Trump's case drop out, as well as a big chunk of these convictions of January 6th rioters. So those are the two dimensions of the dispute. And I do think that whatever happens in the other cases, and there was some skepticism, the court did not embrace my posture. At least it wasn't clear. You all always have to be careful. You know this, David, in reading the bench. It's not always an indication of where they're going to land. But it did seem to me that whatever interpretation they adopt, it's not going to kneecap the Jack Smith prosecution of Donald Trump for obstructing an official proceeding because he used false documents, the fake electoral certificates.
Okay.
And so, and Amy Coney Barrett actually asked a hypothetical about a fake certificate.
Let's imagine that we agree with you. On remand, do you agree that the government could take a shot at proving that your client actually did try to interfere with or obstruct evidence because he was trying to obstruct the arrival of the certificates arriving to the vice president's desk for counting?
I would say no. This statute prohibits operation on specific evidence in some way, shape, or form. Attempting to stop a vote count or something like that is a very different act than actually changing a document or altering a document or creating a fake new
document. Well, he's obstructing evidence in my hypothetical.
I think that signals what's on her mind and that most likely the Trump case will be unaffected. Whatever may happen, too soon to tell with the rest of the cases. But all of that has to be taken with a grain of salt. You don't always know what the Supreme Court is going to do based on the questions from the bench. Sometimes you do.
It is a true and fair warning, and we will likely get the court's opinion at the end of the term, towards the end of June.
Yeah.
And we will then know what they have decided here. Ambassador Normeisen, thank you so much for your time. I greatly appreciate it.
David, always a pleasure talking with you.
That's it for this week's edition of the CNN Political Briefing. And we want to hear from you. Is there a question you'd like answered about this election cycle? Is there a guest you really want to hear from? Give us a call at 301-842-8338 or send us an email at cnnpoliticalbriefing@gmail.com. And you might just be featured on a future episode of the podcast, so don't forget to tell us your name, where you're from, how we can reach you, and if you give us permission to use the recording on the podcast. CNN Political Briefing is a production of CNN Audio. This episode was produced by Grace Walker. Our senior producer is Haley Thomas. Dan DeZula is our technical director, and Steve Lichtai is executive producer of CNN Audio. Support from Alex Manisseri, Robert Mathers, John Dianora, Lainey Steinhardt, Jamis Andrist, Nicole Pesaru, and Lisa Namero. And special thanks to Katie Hinman. We'll be back with a new episode on Friday, April 26th. Thanks so much for listening.